For mental patients, one missing doctor and a trip to New York City to see the Yankees play. What could possibly go wrong? Meet the most dysfunctional field trip group in history, a delusional Jesus impersonator with the heart of a salesman, a rage-filled pathological liar, an introverted Hawaiian shirt-wearing Yankees fan that only communicates as a baseball announcer, and a neurotic neat freak with control issues. When their doctor gets hospitalized witnessing a murder on the way to Yankee Stadium, the gang is left to fend for themselves in the Big Apple. Armed with nothing but sarcasm, psychosis, and a complete disregard for normal social behavior, this group must not only survive each other, but the Big Apple. And along the way, find their doctor. This week on Back to the Balcony, we discuss the 1989 comedy, The Dream Team.
Gene Siskel and Roger Ebert, two titans of cinematic review. Sometimes right, sometimes wrong, but always captivating. Your hosts Antonio of the Cult Worthy Cinema Podcast and Justin Henson of the Movie Wire are here to take you back to the balcony.
Okay, so I'm excited that we're kind of getting back into the rhythm here, because this is one that I wanted to bring to the table a while ago, because this one, I think as a kid, I must have watched about 100 times over and over again when it went on the USA Network or wherever it may be. This is a complete rainy day subtle comedy, and this didn't do that well in theaters, and it's no surprise to it, because this was kind of a year after Christopher Lloyd and Roger Rabbit, a year before Batman with Keaton, and this is where comedies really did go on the subtle aspect, where you really didn't run to the theater to go see, and this was the beginning or the end of the crescendo of the 90s, where we got dirtier and dirtier situational comedies. This is one of those movies that I still like to revisit just to kind of relax, have some subtle laughs. It's a comedy that may not bust your gut in laughter, but it has heart. And that's what I really appreciated about this movie, is that all of our characters on screen, we can feel for, and I absolutely love.
Okay, I can tell this is going to be a good conversation, because I feel the exact same way, because I feel like this is one of those movies that I just consider safe and comforting. And that is the era. Like the mid-80s to early 90s is when you had these films. I'm going to go ahead and throw a few out there that I would put on that list. I would say that The Money Pit is probably one, or Overboard. The Couch Trip, which is a very similar film to this, with Dan Aykroyd and Walter Matthau, who are escaped mental patients. They're movies that they have a nice blend of laughs, heart, a little bit of thrills and tension. I'd say Three Men and a Baby even is essentially that way too, where there are movies, like you said, rainy day afternoon, I'm not going to make an effort to watch it, but if it's on, I'm going to sit and watch it, and I know I'm going to enjoy it because it is like comfort food to me. And maybe that's just a generational thing. Like maybe that's because you and I, we were like around the same age watching these movies on the afternoon TNT movie hour or whatever, right? Like, it's just something that was on, it was there, it was comfortable, and the characters feel like family. They're mental patients, they're escaped, but they never feel that dangerous. They almost feel like it could be the crazy uncles that you don't spend that much time with, and you're getting to watch them in a movie. And I love the fact that they all represent different types of psychoses, where you have, you know, the violent, outlandish one. You have the one with a God complex. You have the one with like the superiority complex. And then you have the one with the inferiority complex. It essentially has a place for everyone who's feeling any of those complexes in their lives. And you can identify with those personalities almost like a Ninja Turtle, right? You're going to be attracted to the character that most reflects you. And that's what I like about this movie. And that it's not too aggressive in its tone. It's not too aggressive in its message. And I think for people that miss the point of this movie, it's they're looking for a message and they're looking for a point, where I don't think there really is one. This is just kind of a movie saying, hey, we're all a little bit crazy. And this is what happens to people who kind of let the craziness take them over. So yeah, I agree. Not the best movie in the world, but I love watching it when it is available.
And this one, I 100%. I think people were looking for another One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest that our critics will get into. And they were looking for something of messaging just because it surrounds mental illness. And it doesn't have to be. It's either this is going to make you really, really laugh or it's going to tell a message. This movie kind of just lands in between. It doesn't really try to do anything. Its intent is pretty clear, is that it just wants to entertain. I look at movies like Sister Act, even if you will, or Three Fugitives, or even Fatherhood at a point, where you put these situational characters in that is meant that you know you're going to get a heartfelt reaction by the end of it, and you're going to feel good in the journey. Yes, it does add some unnecessary thrills in it, but I think to me that adds a little bit of heart, a little bit of mix for everybody that's watching it. We saw the same in like Sister Act, that it tries to go to a vast audience. If you don't want to feel heart, fine. You want to laugh? Fine. Or you want to feel a little bit of a thrill? Fine. These are what makes the perfect rainy day movies, is you get a mixed bag of multi-genre to really target everybody sitting on the couch and picking something away from it. You don't have to go into this movie really looking for a point. You don't need to compare it to anything because it stands on its own on just pure entertainment. And that's what the intent is. At no point, even during my rewatch, did I go into it looking for something different, looking for a message. But I did at the same time feel the same way that I did as a kid watching it. I felt for these characters. I care for our four characters' journey. And I think that was the intent, is to feel for these characters, not to have a message by the end of the climax.
I also like there's like kind of an anti-establishment tone to it as well, where the doctors, the people who were in charge of the asylum, they, yes, are there to try and treat these people's illnesses, but I never feel like anyone except for Dr. Weitzman is actually there to cure them, right? And I think it's a nice reflection of what people would say Western civilization, mental health, and the healthcare industry is all about. If we cure you, we can't make money. So instead, we're going to treat you and feed your psychosis or feed your illness so you are dependent on us. And they definitely make that message well with everyone else in the hospital. And that's why they think that Dr. Weitzman's plan of let's get these guys to a ball game and let them feel like normal people and let them face like the consequences of their actions, but also the day-to-day life that they were facing in the real world before they committed themselves to mental health and psychiatry, you know? So I think there's a good little message in that too. When it comes to the response of audiences and critics of the day, it's really interesting to me because, you know, I went through and I read a bunch of the Amazon reviews and the reviews on Letterboxd, and the people that love this movie are people like you and me, people that grew up with it. I was trying to think of like what was going on in the late 80s to early 90s where, like you said, this was kind of like the swan song of films like this. I think the fact that like home video had really found an audience with movies that did not have to be seen on the big screen to be appreciated, while the spectacle of blockbuster films like The Abyss, which was the same year, Aliens a few years before, then the Terminator movies, and then once Jurassic Park hits, forget it. It almost feels like that was what the big screen experience was supposed to be, and films like this, in my opinion, are better appreciated and better absorbed in an environment where you don't feel like you have to share an experience with an audience around you. It's a personal movie experience. And I watched this by myself. I think I watched it almost 2.5 times by myself, you know, because my partner wasn't interested. And normally she is. But it is a movie that I find more entertaining when I'm allowed to enjoy it on my own terms, in my own environment, because it just speaks to me more than anyone else. I think that everyone has a movie or two like that in their life where it's like, no, I don't need to share this experience with you. I'm just going to go watch this by myself. This is my comfort film. And I'm not going to say that this is my particular comfort film, but it definitely is in the roster of them. So I miss this era of filmmaking where you can have a delightful cast. And even though I'm going to say the screenplay isn't top notch, it is the performances of these characters and these actors. They're geniuses that bring a lot of heart to the table. And especially in things like Peter Boyle and Michael Keaton's performances, you can tell that there's a lot of improvisation that helps make their characters feel a bit more personable. And I like it because it kind of does add to the fact that they are outside of the box. They are not sticking to the lines of whatever the word is on the page. And that just makes me feel even closer to these characters, that they do feel spontaneous.
I think when you're watching, and you're 100% right, this was a performance-driven movie. The dialogue isn't great, but the cast is fantastic. And I think what really made it for me is the ensemble. They bounce off of each other really well. The chemistry is there. But if I had to pinpoint one that goes against the current in this, that would be Christopher Lloyd Henry. Because from the beginning, you feel bad for him. In the middle, you feel bad for him. And by the time we get to that big scene with his daughter and his wife, we feel a sense of relief. We feel heart for him, but relief that he got an interaction with somebody, that he let his control down. And I think that's what this movie, to me, is really about, is a Henry journey, not necessarily the four. It's this, the entire cast guiding Henry to fix and have a little bit of chaos in his life and be okay with that. We have our doctors try and do it. We have all the doctors going with this fantasy while he's critiquing Billy's fantasy. But this journey with Henry is the one that really impacted me. And I think this was a whole Henry movie on how his journey comes to a beautiful climax.
Oh, no, I agree with you. And one of the biggest complaints I have of not only our critics' reviews, but other contemporary critics of the time, is that everyone wants to just say it's like, oh, it's trying to be the modern version of One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest. 100% disagree, because you might think, just because of the marketing or maybe how the film starts, that this is going to be Michael Keaton's movie and he's essentially playing McMurphy. That's not what it is. There are these four guys that are symbiotic with each other, and the film and the screenplay do a really good job at spending equal amounts of time with each of these characters, going into their backstory and going through their journey of this life outside of the institution in New York City. If it was a Cuckoo's Nest ripoff, like people are trying to say it is, it would focus solely on the Billy Caulfield character, the Michael Keaton character, as if it was the Jack Nicholson character. And it doesn't do that. Also, it doesn't show like the tyranny of the mental institution. Like I said, just because they're not trying to cure these people, they're just treating them. At no point do we feel like there's a nurse ratchet situation, or that these people are looked at as less than human. Yes, they are very stereotypical diagnosed by these doctors, but there isn't like this weird kind of power dynamic that makes Cuckoo's Nest so impactful. Like, that is a story of conformity and like the anti-establishment, but using the world of an insane asylum to tell its story. Where I think this is different, I think this is all about like internal struggles with people and then dealing with it on the outside, where like New York City actually represents the real world and all these people that have this internalized trauma, how they are kind of facing the real world. It's nothing like Cuckoo's Nest, other than the fact that it just happens to be about people who are from an insane asylum. I mentioned it earlier, Couch Trip is very similar, where you have these two guys that once they get out into the real world, they're crazy. They are people from an asylum, but they are looked at as geniuses because they are so against the grain of normal society. You know, Dan Aykroyd essentially plays a guy who has been in therapy for years and uses his quack therapy on the real world. And it's just crazy stuff from his head, but the world's so poisonous and toxic that they think it's like scripture. It's the same kind of thing they're talking about, where it's not the people who are the problem. It's the world that's the problem. And these people are just lost in it. So I hate the transparency of people's naivety of saying that this is just a Cuckoo's Nest ripoff because it's based in an insane asylum.
This is one of the critiques I've always hated about this movie is comparing it to One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest is because it's almost like we take alien movies. You see E.T., everything's going to compare to E.T. Our critics are victim to that as well. You see an end of the world movie, you compare it to your favorite end of the world movie. And then you take a great movie like One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest, and that's the standard. You have to match that tone. You have to match those performances. You have to match that formula. And it doesn't have to be. And I take offense to it, especially with this movie, with mental illness, that there are so many vast spectrums. There are so many vast illnesses. There are so many vast personalities to really explore, to take these characters to a different level. It doesn't have to be One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest. It doesn't. This is on a completely different level, and it's not on a better level, but it's on a good entertainment level that these characters should be in their sandbox, in their playground to do what they want, along with our writers, to take a topic, a situation, and maybe have some cliche moments, but it's what the characters do with those cliche moments, and it shouldn't be compared to something that had a higher standard. This, and we even take, I don't know, even comedies going into the 90s that followed kind of the same, how dirtier can we get or how raunchier can we get? That became the same thing, and we got those dirty jokes in the same situations, and nobody compared it to those situations. But you're not going to take Big Mama's House or Road Trip and compare it to Trains, Planes, and Automobiles because it just doesn't make sense because it's a traveling movie. So this is where it's completely off base and unfair to release a movie of mental illness and these characters, unique characters, and compare it to an Academy Award winning movie.
And with the performances, if there's one thing that I can really appreciate about this is if we think about One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest, well, we think of Jack Nicholson because it doesn't matter what movie he's in. He makes sure that it is the Jack Nicholson show. Where in this case, you know, at this point, Michael Keaton has had several leading man roles. He hasn't hit Batman yet, same year, but it's not quite yet. Peter Boyle, same thing. He's had very strong leading man roles, a lot of great supporting character roles. Christopher Lloyd, I mean, he's essentially like in his prime at this moment, right? He's already had a few of his best roles. He's had Roger Rabbit. He's the same year putting out Back to the Future Part 2. Part 3 would be the year after. Yet these four guys, there's such a strong lack of ego in their performances. No one's trying to be the star. No one's trying to be the guy. And to me, that shows a lot of restraint from the cast to say, hey, this is the Dream Team movie. And it's all about us coming together as a unit and not trying to outshine one another. And then in the terms of filmmaking and directing, the director really having like the wherewithal to understand that this can't be the Michael Keaton show. This can't be the Christopher Lloyd show. And so really making sure, even in the framing, that no one is actually spending too much time solo in front of the camera, because each character has their own separate side stories that deal with other people. Michael Keaton's got Lorraine Bracco as ex-girlfriend that he's dealing with, Christopher Lloyd with his family, Peter Boyle with his old ad agency, you know, where the copywriter, where he's like the best guy, and he kind of crumbled under the weight of his own ego. And so this God complex that he has now that he thinks he's Jesus, it's great metaphorically, and he delivers it really, really well, even if the dialogue and the way it's written isn't 100% clear on that's what it is. He brings that to the table so it makes it clear what it's actually doing. And then Stephen First, even though his Albert character is kind of like the lower tier of the group, he definitely brings the heart to it because he is the one that really struggles the most out on his own in the world. And the fact that they do reluctantly make sure that he's okay and not like out just to suffer the city of New York on his own, he actually brings a lot of the final conflict and resolution to the story, not only with the team, but also with the conflicts that we deal with. So even though he has to wait for his hero moment, it seems well-deserved because he is the least active of the group because he's kind of the scared one. So again, like, even though I'm not a huge fan of the dialogue, I think the structure, especially character structure with these characters, is what really makes the movie work.
Absolutely. And even taking on to the Albert character, this is what I think was smart about this character, is you have the conflicts with all the other characters. They get into trouble. They confront their past in New York City. But then you take Albert, the one that doesn't talk, and he has almost the least amount of conflict that almost acts as a message in itself, is shut your mouth and you'll be fine. And he is the one that actually does, in a way, bring these guys together, is he is the central piece of it. And he's the one that doesn't talk. He's the one that, while I'm watching from start to finish, I had the least amount of sympathy for. And that's not in a bad way. He has a presence on screen in his just body language that he is a stronger than what we think character. And as we see all these other characters struggle in the city with their conflict, and they're, and the group is conflicting with each other, he's just kind of the rock. He's there. He has his body language that really does simplify that that he is going to be a big piece of the climax, and he is going to be a big piece of this movie to really unite this team with no spoken words.
And for like the secondary characters, you know, Lorraine Bracco, I think, is fun as always. Really surprised and pleasantly surprised, I should say, to see Dennis Boudiscaris in the movie. We've already covered a film with him. He's Mason, the bearded Kenny Loggins lookalike in Batteries Not Included. As soon as he showed up, I'm like, I know this guy from somewhere. I'm like, oh, it's the Batteries Not Included guy. So it was good seeing him. And then we talked about how, like, it is kind of, I don't know, forced in there, having this conflict with these dirty cops that are looking to cover their tracks of a murder, right? And Dr. Weitzman was the witness, and they want to take him out. You know, Philip Bosco as O'Malley and James Remar, they don't have to do much, because these are two actors that are just known for their menacing face and their menacing appearance and their menacing attitude in any movie. So they don't have to do much. They just have to be there. And if you're an 80s, 90s baby, you're like, oh, I know these guys. These guys are trouble. They're always the bad guy. That's just enough to know that these are the threatening elements of the movie. They don't need too much screen time, which is great because they don't. But the time that they have on there, you do feel the threatening nature of these characters. So whatever gets lost in context is made up for in just presence by these guys. So like I said, even though they're not the strongest or fleshed out characters, the fact that they are who they are and that just they're there makes up for the lack of conflict on page. So even though it is forced in there, that there is like a thriller element to make the movie a little bit more interesting, does it need it? No. But it does give certain characters a hero moment, and it does put stakes in a movie other than just being lost in New York.
I think you're right. And a lot of critics are going to agree with that as well, that it isn't necessary. But there wasn't a moment that they appeared on screen that I didn't have a little stake in it. I didn't have a little threatening moment of, man, what's going to happen? Especially when they enter that hospital, it's what's going to happen next. Where are they going to take this? Even during my rewatches, I still felt a little bit of tension. Just like you said, the mere presence of these two, they are menacing. And again, does it need it? No. Could we have gone to a character focus? Sure, but I don't care. Because these two are really effective. And even though I think they're in it a little bit shorter than what I wish we could have had, because I think they do a fantastic job on any time they're showing menace on screen or threatening behavior on screen. But I think I wouldn't have changed that for anything, because it is effective, especially when we lead to the climax, because the climax is effective. It's thrilling. And again, we want to root for these guys. We want to root for that hero moment. And we can't root for a hero moment without a proper villain. And these two do a great job.
No, I agree. Like, it is what the film needs to have that, like, kind of closure, especially for the Albert character. Okay, so, you know, I think we both agree, we're not going to say this is the best movie ever, but we like it, and it's a comfortable movie. And I, like I said, it's a safe movie. It's just one of those movies that you don't get any, like, ill intent from the film. You're not going to be offended by any of the humor. There might be some, like, some, you know, non-PC clatures of people, but that is of its time, and I would feel like it's even tame by today's standards. Yeah. So it's really, it's a challenge to make a film about, let's say, mentally disenfranchised people without feeling offensive. And I feel like the moments that I would normally be offended are actually corrected in the dialogue or in the performance, because they are like the springboard to understand these characters better, you know? So like calling someone a psychopath, calling someone crazy, calling someone insane, it might sound offensive coming out of one person's mouth, but then you do understand that that is needed to help the character reach the fulfillment of their story. And I think that's fine. Today's standards, I think it would be a little too sensitive on some of the material. I still think it's practically harmless and safe, and I like it. So let's hear what our critics had to say. This was Gene's to bring to the show.
This film is called The Dream Team. It's an all-too-familiar would-be comedy about four mental patients out on their own in the big city. Michael Keaton plays one of the patients taken to New York City for a baseball game, but while the group is taking a break at a gas station, the therapist in charge is beaten up by some homicidal cops, and one of the other patients, a baseball-obsessed introvert played by Stephen Furst, he witnesses the doctor's assault and his disappearance. The Dream Team tries to be both a comedy and a little thriller. I certainly didn't laugh, and I certainly wasn't caught up in any of the drama about whether the killers would be captured. The whole film suffers by comparison, of course, with One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest, and I didn't find anything funny or insightful about its array of would-be mental patients. This is TV sitcom material, bad TV sitcom material.
Okay, so first of all, we have to talk about the One Flew Over the Cuckoo's comparison. I think that you're setting yourself up for disappointment if you're going into this movie automatically assuming that it's going to be, oh, this is the 80s, maybe yuppie version, sitcom version of One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest. You are setting yourself up for disappointment because that's not what it is. Therefore, you are not going to appreciate what the film is actually giving to you. I think that he went in with an agenda, and we've seen him do that before, and it's obvious in the way he just described the film and how he expressed his initial response to it.
Absolutely. And when it comes to the marketing, and I can't assume if they saw the poster, the trailer before going into this movie, but let's just say they did. If you're looking at One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest, the trailer, the poster compared to the Dream Team trailer and poster, they're completely contrasting. So you can look at the marketing of the Dream Team and know kind of an idea of what you're going to get. It's not going to be a masterpiece. It's going to be a movie you go in to be entertained. And we talk about intent. This is a movie that intends not to be a masterpiece. It intends not to have big laughs, but it is intended to make you feel good while you watch it and kind of just subtly remember some memorable moments walking out. That's what this movie was. It wanted to stay linear. It wanted to stay with audiences that really did touch different genres to really please whoever bought a ticket to this movie. So it is an unfair comparison to One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest. I've met a lot of people that didn't like One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest and some that do love it. And this one will land in the middle that you can't hate it. You can't love it. You can just, like us, we're in the middle of it, and you can tell that was the entire intent of this movie.
I also hate like the pretentious idea that you are owed laughs from a comedy, right? Like, for example, Doctor Strangelove is not a laugh-out-loud riot comedy. It is a dark humor political satire that, yes, it's got a lot of laughs, but I think the reason why it is so iconic is because it's not laugh out loud. It's reflective comedy. And I don't think that comedies should be based on how much you guffaw at, you know? In fact, some of the movies that I think are the most laugh out loud funny are actually terrible movies. They've just got really funny moments where I think an underrated or an underappreciated motif of some good comedies and clever comedies is the fact that they can keep you entertained, lighthearted, laughs, a good feeling at the end of the movie in your heart, but you don't feel like you are exhausted from laughter. I think that that is a very clever way of making a feel-good movie. In fact, I think a lot of rom-coms are so popular with people because that's what it makes them feel. They're not as funny as they are heartwarming, right? And I feel that this movie is more in tune with that than what I think the marketing was saying it was going to be. This isn't like a Marx Brothers, four guys tripping all over each other, pratfall kind of movie. The poster might look like that, but that's not what it is.
Well, and I would think, I would have loved to see their reviews of Wes Anderson movies now, where you don't get that laugh out loud chuckle. You get good filmmaking and okay storytelling, but you don't get that laugh out loud funny. So, and comedy is so vast that, you know what, you might not get it, but at the same time, you're either going to walk out feeling something or you're going to walk out thinking. And apparently Gene didn't have any of it.
Correct. And Roger did not have too dissimilar of an opinion.
There were moments that I liked, but generally speaking, I agree with you. They didn't crank this up to the level of craziness, if you will, that the material really needs.
Yeah.
It's to a peculiar degree, it's kind of lax. It doesn't really seem to have the energy level that it needs. It sort of moves along in a kind of a logical
it's
way.
Neither
in fact, it ought to reach some kind of a peak of insanity.
It's neither about the people, really.
No.
It doesn't really deal with the people. And it doesn't really deal with the story that they're caught up in, which is trivial stuff. I mean, whether the cops or how they're going to catch the cops. I don't know what this movie is about.
So again, hard to disagree. I think it's 100% about the people and less about the things that he's looking for. So again, I just don't think they understood the assignment of the movie. This wasn't a laugh out loud comedy. It wasn't a total thriller. When they're saying it's not enough of one and not enough of another, that's the point. It's not supposed to be one or the other. It's supposed to be a great blend of the two because you're dealing with the four guys and their inner struggles. I think that they wanted to see, like I said, Keystone Cop moments of these four just kind of being wild and crazy and stumbling all over each other in New York City. And instead, we get very introspective, heartwarming moments of discovery from all of them. The great scene where Peter Boyle goes into the Episcopal Church, right? And he starts preaching and they're all with him. And then he gets a little bit out there and he starts calling himself Jesus and he starts taking off his clothes. And you see their response go from cheer and joy to like, oh, what is this crazy white guy doing, right? I loved that moment. And I don't think that they understood what that moment represented, is that this is the beginning of his journey to understand that he does have this God complex that he's created, but only he and the people who enable him in the hospital feed that psychosis. In the real world, no one is going to feed it. And that is a very important moment for his self-reflection and his journey. But I think they were just looking for laughs. They were looking for ha-ha moments, and it's not a ha-ha moment. In fact, it's almost painful and uncomfortable, like a Larry David thing, because that shows what the real world would do to this guy.
After every watch, I have to look at the preacher's reaction in the background and see when he finally realizes what the hell's going on. Just a pure panic. But I think if I were their age at that point, I can see the adult me knowing where this is coming from, is wanting to go all in, wanting something more adult. But the painful thing is if they went all in, if they actually went outlandish, then it wouldn't have been memorable. It would have been lost in translation of every other comedy that comes out. And it wouldn't have been from kids to teenagers to adults to really enjoy this, because you can really sit down as a family. There's really nothing inappropriate per se in this movie to say you can't have kids watch this, with maybe a conversation of the what and the why. But this is a safe movie, and that to me is what makes it memorable, is that you can actually have multiple ages sit down and enjoy a safe comedy. And it doesn't have to be outlandish when we're just because we have a group of people with mental illness. It doesn't have to be. It can be subtle humor about people, about humans, and how they interact with each other and how they deal with their conflicts. That's the point of the movie, is to have that heart and to have that humor and how they deal with life situations. We don't need to stereotype these characters for mental illness. It is just stereotyping the movie you want to have because you saw it done better.
Agreed.
Well, let me ask you this. We get the four characters at the beginning.
Yes.
Each one has his trait. Each one has his problem. What kind of a movie would it have been like if they had been let loose in the real city of Manhattan in order to deal with it as they are, instead of being plugged into, you're quite right, another sitcom comedy about how the bad guys are trying to break in the hospital and murder this person, and they're trying to save him, and it just all becomes formula.
They haven't even written four interesting characters. No. Michael Keaton is a good actor. We saw him play a drug addict in Clean and Sober. He's not playing a crazy person. That is not a crazy person or a mentally ill person there. It's just Michael Keaton doing things that are somewhat supposed to be funny. Like just, Bill Murray is playing...
What discourages me is when they just basically just plug it into a formula instead of saying, okay, if these are the characters, what would happen to them?
Yeah, no,
the film
doesn't have that kind of guts.
So, I don't know. Dare I say that I feel like these two are gatekeeping mental illness in the sense of what they expect cinematic representations of mental illness to be. It's not mental illness unless they're tearing their hair out and running around in straitjackets and being so formulaic that it's almost borderline offensive. I think the brilliance of Michael Keaton's character is that this isn't a guy with actual, let's say, socially debilitating mental illness. It's a guy who knows that he's on the verge of doing something dangerous, and he's protecting himself and the people he loves from the demons within. That is a mental condition, but it's not appreciated back then because it would have just been considered being either ultra masculine. These days we still call them toxic or violent, but it is an actual illness. It is a social stigma that he recognizes. He had been probably told by people that were close to him that he needs it fixed. And that's why he's there before it becomes too dangerous and gone too far for him to ever recover. But because he's not scratching the walls, these two don't consider it a mental illness. I was actually really offended by the fact that they can just pass that off and say that, oh, this guy isn't crazy. Who are you to say what's crazy or not? Again, we are dealing with these antiquated ideas of these critics of what it represents in cinema. It has to be the people just walking around aimlessly or being really, really crazy, like in Cuckoo's Nest, for it to even register on their in their minds that that is a representation of mental illness.
They wanted these characters to be a pure sideshow.
Yep.
They wanted them to dance on stage and entertain them in the way they want to be entertained. And you're right, it is borderline offensive. And this is where we take Keaton's character. And to me, I think they made it pretty clear that it's almost like he's there forcefully by law with his temper tantrums. And they kind of even dig at that with Riley meeting again, that he's in there for 3 months because he did something bad. And this is the nice kiss. They could have just made an angry man, but they put some creativity in him of being an author, where he translates his anger into this fantasy world. So they justify where this is coming from. And I think Gene and Roger missed the boat on that. That is a clever premise. Could it have been explored a little bit more? Yeah, but I think they do a decent enough job setting the scene of where his mental illness is stemming from, his anger issues, and the world around him was making him angry. Or he could have writer's block of not creating something great that's generating that anger. That is an illness for those that are writers that are really struggling in frustration. It outputs their anger. So I think that's what they're really missing, is if you look deeper than just the lines that you didn't like or the characters you didn't like, there is some subtle things here that really does tell a story about these characters.
Yeah, so subtle, 100%. It's the subtext of the characters that make it interesting. And that's where, like, Tarantino says it all the time. He's like, when I create a script and create characters, before I even have a name, I start with the subtext. Why are these people the way they are? And what is their mission to gain our interest in who they are and what they're doing in the film? So, for example, I think it's brilliant the fact that Christopher Lloyd's character, up until like the third act, his whole shtick is that even though he's a patient, he presents himself as a doctor, right? He's probably read all the psychological manuals. He's probably learned all the different things that you can learn from the people who are running these group meetings, from the people that are running all the private sessions, and he's kind of taught himself to be a doctor in his own mind. But in reality, he's just like a sanitation worker. He's a civil servant. So I think that really speaks to the fact that he felt so underwhelmed where he was at in his life with his job, even though he has a family that loves him, that he now presents himself as an intellectual, as an academic, to kind of like fix the loss of where he thinks he should be in life and feeling like a failure as he's middle-aged. I don't think there's a single person on this planet that can't relate to that. Like, oh, I thought I was going to be so much more or so much better than I actually am at this day and age. That's so relatable. That is very good, solid subtext, and they don't even mention it. We already talked about Peter Boyle following under his own soul-crushing ego of being this brilliant copywriter who had a bad pitch and is no longer on top, and now he has this complex. Like, these guys all have amazing subtext, and they don't even appreciate it for 1 second because it's not the movie they were looking for.
You're 100% right. And the moment we get our Henry character, and I think this is a turning point where they don't go all in and go overboard with solving everything, because nothing's really solved. They still kind of go back to the hospital, per se. And Henry, we can tell he hit a breaking point of transition where he meets his daughter and he has to give up his clipboard, but then he hesitates hugging her. So there is a pivotal thing there of bettering oneself where you're not ready yet, or you still feel you're not deserving. And I think that is what really got me in the moment of this movie, where it put the knife in the stake, saying, I'm done. We're not going to solve it, but this is a path where we're going to make you feel, and we're not going to give you all the answers, because that would be unfair to these characters, is to give all the answers. We will make them look good and you want to root for these guys, but we're not going to cure them, because that wouldn't be right in their journey.
Yeah. At the end of the day, I really, really, really enjoy this movie. I have for years. I was so happy to see it on the list, and knowing that we were getting to it, I was like, huh. Like, I can just breathe now and not worry about watching another crappy movie that we haven't seen before or heard of. It was a really, really nice palate cleanser getting us into other films. So, you know, I've been rather complimentary of Gene, especially of the last few reviews that we've done, because the movies were so bad and we agreed with them that they were bad for the same reasons, which is why I gave him favorable reviews. But I think he totally missed the point on this one. He missed the point of the film, the characters, the story. But I also think that he was in the wrong of being so pretentious that he projected an expectation of the film before he even walked in the door. And when it didn't live up to that projection, he instantly just shat on it. So for that, I'm giving him a D.
100% fair. And Roger's not going to fare too much differently here, is he spends most of the review of the woulda, coulda, shouldas based on what he wanted. And again, with comparison of old movies, you know, it's in the back of his mind of going into this movie. So he's probably not too far off of Gene. I will give him a little bit of credit, admitting that he liked some moments, but we don't know what those moments are in his video review. So to me, I think I hate it when 90% of a movie is woulda, coulda, shoulda. And that doesn't entice me to see, should I see it or should I not see it? Because you're telling me what you wanted and what you like, but that's not telling me if I want to watch a movie or not. So, and I think he missed a boat on it, but I'll give him a little bit more credit, saying, acknowledging a couple good things, even though we don't know what they are. I'll give him 1.5 stars.
That extra half. Yeah, no, I think they missed the boat on this one. And, you know, it's subjective. They just didn't like the movie. But I think that their projection of what the movie is supposed to be really missed the point of what the movie actually was. And who knows? I can't remember the first time I watched this movie. I was definitely too young to understand the nuance. But since I've grown up with it and seen it so many times, and I do understand the nuance, I appreciate it a lot more. I can totally see where they came from, having an idea of what this movie was and then what it actually turned out to be, without having the repeat viewings that we've had. And being able to grow up the movie and understanding more of the science and the psychology as we've gotten older, and it makes a lot more sense. So I like that, that this movie is something that you can essentially grow old with, and you'll understand more and more as you reach these different moments, essentially going through each and every character's struggles along the way. So yeah, I think it's a great movie, especially for people that just want a nice, comfortable, safe film from an era that was known for movies like this.
Never has to blow you away, but you know what? I can watch this 100 times and still never feel bored.
Agreed. Okay, so next week I am bringing to the show a film by Robert Altman, which I actually enjoy the film. It is an acquired taste for some, but I think the reason why I really wanted to jump on this one is because it was written by one of my favorite filmmakers, Alan Rudolph, who I had an opportunity to interview on The Cultworthy. And he said this was one of his proudest moments as a writer because it was the first time that everyone that he was writing for appreciated his work, but the audiences didn't. So I want to see what Siskel and Ebert have to say about this film. It is Buffalo Bill and the Indians, directed by Robert Altman, written by Alan Rudolph, and starring Paul Newman. So that will be next week's episode.
Haven't seen it? Can't wait for that one. So that'll be a good discussion.
Yeah, I'm curious because I know that you are hit and miss on Altman, and this will be a good litmus test to see like how far into the depths of Altman can you go before you're like, is this guy just a hack?
Or pure luck.
Right, there you go. All right, everyone. So thank you for watching, listening. Please like, rate, review, 5 stars. Follow us on YouTube, Spotify, Apple Podcasts, anywhere you listen to podcasts. You can find me, Antonio, at the Cult Worthy Cinema Podcast, and you can find all my stuff on thecultworthy.com. You can find my co-host, Justin, over at
themoviewire.com.
Great conversation. I'll see you next week.
See you next week.